The following programming is sponsored by Clean and Sober Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
If you need immediate help, please call the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. Welcome to Clean and Sober Radio, brought to you in part by Recovery Centers of America, the nationally recognized leader in drug and alcohol treatment, using proven evidence-based treatment, including 24/7 medically supervised detox, inpatient and outpatient options. You'll receive exceptional care from an expert team of master-level clinicians, physicians, nurses, and staff using 12-step methodology and medications. Jefferson University Hospitals and Thomas Jefferson University, providing excellent clinical and compassionate care in the Philadelphia region. A proven leader in healthcare and education since 1825. And Acadia Healthcare, with locations on the East Coast. Acadia maintains a standard for excellence in the treatment of behavioral health and addiction concerns. And now, here are your hosts, Gary Handler and Mark Sigmund.
Hey, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show. Clean and Sober Radio features real people with real stories about addiction to drugs and alcohol. Mark, what's new this week in recovery news?
Oh, we have a lot of news. Out of Las Vegas, Nevada, this is an unfortunate story. Tyler Kennedy, 33, just pled guilty to three counts of DUI causing death. Last year, police had pulled him over. He was smoking fentanyl in his car. The police went on to let him go, and he went and he killed a family. He killed a 13-year-old girl along with her parents, pled guilty. And you know what he said at the trial? They should not have let me go because of a lot of the blame is going to be on them.
Well, my question is, why did they let him go? They caught him with fentanyl?
They caught him with fentanyl. Basically, they stopped him and we're searching for weapons because there was a holdup nearby and he's a career criminal. And so they didn't stop him for the smoking fentanyl. They didn't come up on him, you know, for the smoking fentanyl. So it's very unfortunate, you know, and it just shows how we've been talking about DUIs the last couple weeks. You know, the accidents and everything. So
tragic. What else
tragic.
You got?
Secondly, if we think it couldn't get worse, out of Tampa, Florida, a new drug 20 to 100 times stronger than fentanyl is now making its way into common street drugs across the United States. It's called isotonitazine, referred to as ISO. It's creating problems for spring breakers in Florida right now.
Was this drug legitimate? Was it used for anything legitimate?
No, it was manufactured in China. It's coming up through Mexico. And they've had overdoses they're starting to find throughout the United States, and it's becoming more common. So just when we think, you know, fentanyl's bad, we've been hearing about it, car fentanyl and things like that, but this new one, ISO, is causing big problems.
Unbelievable. What else you got?
So the final story we got is kind of interesting. A venomous sea snail could be key to more effective painkillers with a lower risk of addiction. A deadly venom produced by cone snails that has occasionally killed humans, and there is no antitoxin available. You know, for some reason, they can use this as a painkiller.
Hey, Mark, who's your source on this one?
This one is out of Health.
So you're gonna go fishing this summer and get these snails? Is that what you're gonna do?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty interesting because they're saying this. It's a piece of this venom is not as addictive or not going to be as addictive as what we're seeing on the market today. So
three great stories. Yes. Not sure if I believe the last one.
Yeah, it's a little.
But it certainly is entertaining. And if it's true, it's great.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't know where they'll find all these snails.
So listen, we're going to go to our first break. When we come back, we have a rabbi from South Jersey who is in recovery for over a decade and has in recent years come out to his congregation and told them he is in recovery. That's a big deal, and we have to give him a lot of credit for that, and we will be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
If you're struggling with alcohol or drugs, Recovery Centers of America can help. RCA's local inpatient and outpatient programs are founded on science and delivered with heart from an expert, caring team who will inspire and guide you every step of the way. Call 1-888-RECOVERY now to speak with a treatment advisor. At RCA, you'll be in a community that builds connections and fosters support from peers and RCA's team of medical professionals and recovery support specialists. At RCA's state-of-the-art campus in Devon, PA, and Mays Landing, New Jersey, they tailor your treatment to you and also offer specialized programs for patients with history of trauma, for patients who have achieved recovery but are experiencing a relapse, for young adults, adults 50 years and older, a confidential program for first responders and military, and a faith-based program. RCA answers the phone and accepts patients 24/7. And because it's local and in-network with insurance providers, treatment is affordable and accessible. Don't wait. Call 1-888-RECOVERY. Recovery today.
This is Rabbi Michael Parise, and you're listening to Clean and Sober Radio with my favorite humans, Gary and Mark.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Heard on these great stations across America, WWDB Philadelphia, KDWN Las Vegas, Nevada, WHFS Tampa, Florida, and WGAC Augusta, Georgia. Welcome to the show, Rabbi Michael Parise.
Hey, you know,
welcome.
You know you've made it on Clean and Sober Radio when you got a drop.
So. Yes. And he sure did give us a compliment, huh?
Yeah, it was great. It was,
we're his favorite humans.
Favorite humans.
All right, here's the headline.
Yep.
Michael Parise is in recovery from an opioid addiction, and then you went public with your congregation several years ago. That took a lot of strength, I can tell you that. Let's go back and find out how you got there.
Yeah, so that story went international, and wow. I think that on some level I knew when I put Rabbi before this story, people were going to pay attention. I was banking on that,
yeah,
because I wanted this to become a story that would normalize addiction in America. I never knew just how far it would travel. I mean, I was in Israel 2 weeks after making this announcement on the news, talking about this issue. That's how pervasive this issue is. That's how many people it affects. That so many people are interested on this topic.
And you know what it shows us, Mark? You know, addiction has no boundaries. A doctor, a lawyer, a priest, a rabbi, there are no boundaries, you know, of being an addict or an alcoholic or both.
And so many people, because of their profession, fight this thing in complete privacy and isolation and are stuck.
Yeah. So before we get to how you told the congregation, I would have been scared to death. You grew up, nice kid.
Yeah.
In, where? In South Jersey?
Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Cherry Hill. So what was your family life like?
My family life, I had a great upbringing, great family life. My mom's from Philadelphia. My family owns Jewish funeral homes in the Philadelphia area. My father's an Italian Catholic from Camden. So two different people coming together, worlds collide. But I had your just typical suburban upbringing, really good family, really grounded in great values. And my entry into addiction was innocent and tragic, like millions of Americans. I was in a car accident, 2007, driving back from Temple University where I was a student, at the bottom of a red light, in my rear view, see a person texting on their cell phone, high speed, coming at me, no way they're going to stop, brace for impact, hit me, and from there, really bad issues. I had a whiplash, shoulder issue, but it was a dislocated disc that was causing sciatic nerve pain, which was how I originally sought out the medication.
Were you using drugs years before as a teenager?
I experimented with drinking and pot at times, but yeah. I nothing ever really stuck. I didn't like it. You know, marijuana always made me really paranoid. Yeah. I never understood why people loved this thing. So I never really took to drugs in the way other people did. Yeah.
So here's – I guess this is a message that the power of opioids, anybody, you know. And we hear so many times, Mark, that people, you know, they get hurt innocently. They go to a doctor. The doctor most likely overprescribes because they don't know what they're doing.
And I want to say something about that, Gary. I want to interject because I think this is really important. We don't know what we know now 10 years ago. Some doctors acted very unethically. But I think many doctors were just lied to by the pharmaceutical companies. They said these medications aren't addictive. And I think that mentality, for right or wrong, seeped into our culture. And that's where you see that over-prescribing.
Yeah, I'm not saying these doctors, the crooked ones we know.
There's a lot of them, too.
I'm saying that doctors are uneducated.
Yeah.
It was not malicious.
Yeah.
But, you know, they went
a lot
with
of
the
damage.
Program.
Yep.
And, but I think they could have seen a guy like you, Rabbi, coming back. Oh, not you, but
back, but that's,
over
that was
and
me.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
They have to say to themselves, hey, whoa.
By the third or fourth time I went back to get my prescription, because, you know, listen, painkillers, it's an ironic thing. They don't actually fix your pain. They actually cause the pain to be worse, because when you're coming down off the medication, your pain's spiking. It's intensifying. So, you know, a few weeks into this thing, I'm like, I'm in worse shape than when I started. So I go back to the doctor. All right, here's a little more. Go back a third time. Here's a little more. By the fourth time, whoa. Yeah. We can't keep up in your prescription, but it's already too late. Firmly addicted at that point, even if you don't realize it.
Isn't it scary? I mean, the drugs that I think you – I know the drugs that I took. You couldn't die from them back then. And I'm not so sure they were addictive.
They weren't as addictive as we see with these opioids. You know, the thing that really, as a counselor, really confuses me sometimes is generally when somebody comes in with addiction, you find this huge family history. But I've had a ton of people come in with instances like this where they had an injury, and you're not finding a family history of addiction. So you wonder, like, it's kind of the perfect storm because it's a painkiller, so it's numbing somebody out, right? So they don't a lot of times realize how far they're going in.
And do you think somebody like Rabbi was predisposition of addiction?
Well, let's ask. Do you have it in your family?
You know, I have insight into this. You know, I had an uncle who was a lifelong addict, but he wasn't blood related. So that's why I kind of never thought it could happen to me. And, you know, that's what racks the brain. Is it a predisposition? Is it genetic? Is it self-medicating if you're dealing with anxiety or depression? Is it from an injury? Or is it all these things mixed together? And I think it is. I think it's a combination of all these factors.
Mark and I keep bringing up this instance we've had on the show. Two brothers, identical twins.
Yeah.
One became a professor in Florida.
Yeah.
And one became a heroin addict.
Yeah.
Now, you know, or – in a smaller way, my sister and myself, she never did anything wrong.
Yeah.
We came from the same parents and, you know.
And I think addiction functions differently for everybody. You could give me a glass of wine right now. I could drink it and I'd hate it. I'd go on my way, never think about it. But if you gave me one opiate, just one, something in my brain, it triggered like nothing else ever before. And what is that? I don't know. But you know to stay away from it. Once you
right,
get into
you
recovery.
Can't test. Mark, is there any real concrete evidence of why one person becomes an addict and the other person doesn't, who are genetically connected?
Well, so, you know, they definitely think that there's a huge genetic predisposition to this thing. And sometimes what you find is some members of the family have like a gambling addiction or they have another kind of obsessive compulsive thing.
Okay.
What they've done twin studies on this where, you know, they found that people with parents that are alcoholic have a 50% greater chance of becoming alcoholic themselves. But I'm a believer in kind of what Mike was talking about, and that is you get a whole mixture of causes. You know, you get probably the majority has this genetic piece. Right.
Nothing else would explain the rise in opiates in the past, what, two decades? I mean, it has to be more than just any one thing. And I think people are self-medicating for the pain, for the depression, plus this maybe predisposed genetic piece. And you got this firestorm that we're seeing in our country.
Because for 40 years or 50 years, Percodan and Percocet were out there. And we didn't see a vast epidemic from that. Like we've seen in the last 15, 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, I guess people weren't being exposed to them nearly as much. You know, they didn't have the pharmaceutical companies coming in and hitting the primary care doctors.
They weren't as strong.
You know, giving them, telling them they should prescribe these.
Yeah. Hey, if you're just joining us now, Rabbi Michael Parise is our guest today. He's a rabbi in long-term recovery and a very interesting story. And if you'd like to speak with the rabbi, give us a call at 1-888-329-3306. That's 1-888-329-3306, right?
That's it. We got it right.
Did we get the number right?
We did.
We love people calling in.
Yeah, after 8 years, we've got the number right.
We got the number right after 8 years. And, you know, it's crazy because in the 90s, I mean, certain areas was seeing this, you know, with the opioids coming in the late 90s. But I remember, like, I didn't even hear about them.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even hear about them. It was like ecstasy and there's coke around and there's all these different things. But I didn't even hear about it.
I knew when I was coming, Percocet and Percodan were the big ones.
Yeah. They just weren't making it around the circles
I was
in.
It was there. It's just nobody associated with addiction. I mean, that even years into taking these medications, I didn't think of myself as having an addiction because I was prescribed them. I was in legitimate pain. I didn't get them from a drug dealer. So you trick your mind and then society. But then you start seeing all these people, you know, everybody's kind of dealing with the same thing but not talking about it. It's kind of pointing to a real issue.
Sally T. from Atlanta, Georgia asked, is it true that if you have considerable money, it is easier to get into treatment?
I would say so.
I would say absolutely.
But I would also say there are other options, including meetings, and a lot of rehabs have scholarship money.
Well, and you know, of course, getting on, you know, medical assistance and things like that. Yeah. You know, you can get treatment, but
I think it's true. If you have money, it's easier to navigate
resources,
this whole thing.
Resources play a big part in who gets treatment and who doesn't. That's one of the things we have to change. I always say there's two big issues we got to tackle. The stigma of addiction, because if you don't tackle the stigma of addiction, you're not going to get people the help they deserve, and making it cost efficient for families in America to seek treatment.
Yeah. Let me just go through a couple. We have a lot of people watching us, Rabbi, and maybe you know some. Michael Shoemaker, Debbie Reynolds, Stuart Angelin, Rita Duke, Kathy Wolf Collin, C. Ruger. Good afternoon, if good afternoon to you. Lawrence Miller, Johnny Guthridge. What's up, guys? What's up?
And he says he works with you. And he says,
does he, Rabbi?
Yes. Who's that?
Johnny Guthridge. This is huge.
With a rabbi.
Oh.
I work with a rabbi that helps people in treatment.
Sorry, Johnny, I don't know you, but I'm glad you work with a rabbi.
There you go. Andrea Duffy, hi, Judge. Let me see who else. Laura Story, Janice Ann. Oh, we'll get the Laura Story, dedicating a shy guy from Central Florida. Took me a long time to find you, but I found you. Have a beautiful weekend. Another great week of Clean and Sober. Okay. All right. So you grew up in a fairly normal family.
Yep.
And so, you know, the stories you hear about incredible trauma don't apply to everybody.
Nope.
So were you a good student, Rabbi?
No.
Okay. There's
– Were you getting in trouble?
I was a rebellious teenager. Gotcha. I didn't act out so much in drug use, but I was pretty rebellious. I was a bad student. You know, it took me many years to find myself and to kind of develop – you know, and slow down and understand, you know, how I could better myself. And I think recovery was a big part of that. You know, addiction kind of knocks you down to your most base level. And recovery, though it's hard, it gives you the opportunity to reclaim your life and to reorient yourself. And I needed that because I was kind of, you know, lost and confused after kind of moving off of the opiates.
Let me ask you a question. I just thought about this.
Yeah.
So your family was in the funeral parlor business. Did you ever, did anybody in your family, say to you, hey, listen, you got to slow down. You know how many young people we have buried in our cemeteries?
Yeah.
Was that ever a connection?
Well, no one knew.
Oh, they didn't know you.
No one knew. I mean, people knew that I was on pain medicine because they knew I was in a car accident. My parents, my family, they didn't know how bad it got. And that's the thing about addiction. You become so adept at hiding it. You become so adept at removing yourself from friends and family. And I like to think, I was somewhat high functioning. But the truth was you just get really good at hiding it. And that's how I would say they were shocked to find out when I called them after that great incident I had where I finally decided I needed help.
I think one of the characteristics, at least in the beginning of your addiction, is we can hide everything. You know, a con artist, but it does get to a point where you can't hide anymore.
Eventually, you've told every lie you could tell. You borrowed every dollar you could borrow, and everybody hits that wall. And I hit mine in April 2011.
That was that. Okay, so you hit your wall then.
Yep.
And did you say okay?
So let's go back.
You ran out of everything. Okay, let me ask you.
I'm going into withdrawal, and for those who don't know, and I hope you never have to know, opiate withdrawal is a hell that I cannot truly articulate with words. Minutes last for hours. Hours last for days. Days seem to last for an eternity. You are literally trapped in your body. It's like the flu times a million. And I'm going through my phone book. Nothing. Nobody's there. I'm panicking. But at no point do you think, let me call for help. Let me get help. Because one, you're embarrassed. Two, you know you might have to prolong the withdrawal. So many people want help, but they're scared of the withdrawal. That really keeps millions of Americans from seeking help. Finally call up a friend of mine who's no longer alive. He says, Mike, I got you. I'll be there in an hour. Shows up 3 hours later, knocks on the door, says, listen, I got to go, but feel better. Feel better.
Great.
You know, not get high, have a good time, because it was never about that. For most people going through addiction, it's about getting better. Shuts the door. I look down. It's not pills. It's a bag of heroin. And I'd never taken heroin. It wasn't something I ever was looking to do. And, you know, I'm in real pain, and I would do almost anything to make it stop. And I go into the bathroom, and I'm telling you, there was some change that happened, almost like a calm washed over me where I was able to see if I did this, I was going to die. I just knew it.
I think they call that a spiritual awakening for some people.
I thought it was – later on, I was kind of agnostic at the time. I connected to something spiritual. We could talk about that. I know we probably got to go to a break. But, you know, I flushed the drugs down the toilet. Great decision I ever made. Called my parents, and the rest is history.
Yeah, that's – you know, that defining moment when you are given up for whatever reason, you want to get out of a jam with the law or you've just had it. That's really that's a moment I don't think you ever forget.
No, and I'll never forget it. It was so powerful that it was something that made me want to explore what was that, because I was feeling in a way – you got to remember, I was in the worst way possible, and for this moment of calm and clarity – to kind of come over me out of nowhere. It physically felt different. Like I physically felt like a dramatic change. It only lasted for a few seconds, but it was enough for me to flush the drugs down the toilet and call my parents.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
To this day, I can't explain it. And I don't like talking about it because if I had heard somebody else say that, I don't know what I'd make of it. But it was something powerful to me. And it really kind of provided a lot of meaning in my life.
I mean, was that a precursor to you getting into a man of the cloth, as they say.
So if there was a list of things I thought I'd never be, it'd be rabbi followed by like NFL player. You know, and look at me. I'm
NFL,
like
I know.
Yeah. Well, neither one seemed likely. Yeah. But, you know, it was the start of like maybe there's something bigger than myself. I could – it's a longer story, and I know we don't have a lot of time, but yes, the answer is yes. It was part of what made me want to seek out being spiritual again, not necessarily being a rabbi, but spiritual.
Right. So, okay, if you're joining us now, again, we're with Rabbi Michael Parise, and when we come back, we're going to learn how an individual can go from the depths of an addiction to becoming a religious leader in our community. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Huntington Creek Recovery Center is Eastern Pennsylvania's premier provider of transformative care for individuals whose lives have been impacted by addiction. Our 40-acre campus offers a tranquil, recovery-focused environment. We specialize in evidence-based care that addresses the effects of trauma and offer a unique program specifically for adolescent males. Huntington Creek Recovery Center can help you achieve lasting sobriety. Call us today at 844-948-2320.
Hi, I'm Billy J. Kramer, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
1-888-329-3306 is our number here, and we are talking with Rabbi Michael Parise. And I find it very interesting. Look, even you and I, all the issues we had with drugs, we were able to overcome them and become a productive member of society. And, you know, we see it with the rabbi also. So you wonder, you know, this is not a dead end. We talk about this all the time. This is not a dead end. Mark, you always say, but, you know, you don't have to wait till you hit rock bottom because there's another bottom under that. And there is treatment out there. It's no, you know, there's no delivery. There's no drive-thrus. But look, the three of us sitting here in our heyday, I want to say, nobody would think that we would be sitting around here talking about really long sobriety and recovery.
Especially on a radio show.
On a radio show. Right.
I mean,
giving back.
Yeah.
Who cared about giving back?
Yeah, absolutely.
Listen, I just wanted.
Yeah. Listen, you know? if you can overcome this, you can do anything. And I don't know if I would have believed that in early recovery, but I always tell people, literally, you've already gone through the hard part. If you're in recovery, you've done the hard part. And now your life is open. It's completely open. And I really hope that people get the hope in that because addiction brings a lot of despair.
So, Rabbi, you came out to your congregation.
Yeah.
I imagine that was a scary thing
yes,
in a way.
It was frightening.
Was it a Friday night?
So I kind of planned it out in advance because it took a lot of thinking about how I wanted to do this. I knew the risk. And, you know, I was, you know, before I was walking around my house and my wife said, you're muttering to yourself. I was saying, sometimes you just got to take a leap of faith. Sometimes you just got to take a leap of faith. I knew I needed to do this. I knew how powerful it could be. But I worked so hard to become a respectable member of society, so hard to become somebody people trust and respect. But I knew that shouldn't mean that I can't share this story. And so I decided I was going to call – it was on Zoom because this was a year ago in the height of the pandemic. Call my congregation together and basically just take the time and share the story with them. And it was beautiful, the reception. There was a few people who were, you know, not so positive, but we worked through that. You know, people have different concerns. But by and large, everybody was just so beautifully positive. And that's why I always tell people, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid.
And you were sober at that point, what, 6 years?
No, 10.
You were sober – all right, 10 years.
10 years.
So look, you had the credibility. It wasn't like you're telling the congregation, hey, I just got out of rehab.
Yeah, it wasn't like a week earlier. I mean
– right.
You know, but there was questions of like, should I have said this in my interview? And I actually told them – that'd be illegal. You can't, you know, ask somebody their medical history in an interview. And, you know, the truth is it was my choice. Nobody should have to disclose this if they don't feel they want to. I chose it because I wanted to. I thought it could be a really powerful moment.
So are you finding now, since you disclosed that, are you getting people in your congregation coming to you with either – I have a son, a daughter, a husband.
That was
already
happening. And that was part of the thing that made me want to do it even more. Because you would think as a rabbi going through this recovery that I would know it's actually pervasive, that it's touching a lot of people. But it was kind of a shock. You know, my congregants saying, I have a son, I have a daughter, I have a grandson. You know, they're going through this. And, you know, I haven't been able to speak about it with many people. And I felt like, wow, they don't even know what I've went through. And so, yeah, it was just like a lot of things coming together. It felt like the perfect opportunity.
Now, you were not a rabbi in your addiction, of course.
No.
How long after you got clean did you become a rabbi?
So let's go back in time.
And why did you want to become a rabbi?
Yeah, so this is a great story. So, you know, I got clean in 2011. And, you know, my life is kind of in disarray. I'm going through this recovery process and it's hard. I don't want to ever tell anybody it's not hard. It's very hard. And, you know, I never wanted to be a funeral director. That's what everybody in my family is. But it was a blessing in disguise working at the funeral home when I didn't have any other opportunities because it was the first time in my life that I got to see rabbis doing this amazing work, working with families in their time of need. And it wasn't like, wow, I'm going to be a rabbi. It was like, maybe I could be a Jew again. Because I had all this baggage. We talked about my rabbi, who that was growing up, not a good guy.
Yeah.
But I was like, you know what? Maybe there's something here I could be a Jew again. And I started exploring my Judaism and I'm becoming a Jew. And then I'll never forget, it was December 2012 and there was this horrible snowstorm. I mean, it must have snowed like 3 feet. I don't know. All the funerals were canceled that week except for one. There was a gentleman in his 90s. He had died. He had one living sibling. And we go out to the cemetery in the northeast or somewhere, old cemetery, and all the monuments are so close together you could barely walk through them. With the snow, made it almost impossible. The sister was in a wheelchair. They said she couldn't go to the graveside. She had to sit in the car for her own brother's funeral. And I'm like, this is a travesty. You know, I'm like, in retrospect, it was nobody's fault. But I'm sitting there, I'm watching her, and And I go, you know what? This is wrong. And I go up to the window and I knock on the window. I say, ma'am, my name's Michael. I'm from the funeral home. Can I sit with you? And she kind of motions me in the car. I sit down. We're in the back seat of this car and she's kind of staring out the window towards the funeral. And it's awkward. I say, ma'am, can you tell me about your brother? And she turns to me like she's been waiting for somebody to ask that question. She says, you know, my brother saved my life. We escaped the Nazis. We had to walk across Europe together to get to safety. All these amazing stories. And I had this revelation. It's the first time in my life I'm just listening. I've never just listened to somebody in my life. And I could hear the service wrapping up behind me. And I'm not very religious at this time, but I knew one prayer, only one prayer. It's called the Mourner's Kaddish. It's only said at times of death or the anniversary of deaths. And I said, ma'am, would you like to say the Mourner's Kaddish with me? And we said this prayer. And the look on her face was like I had just given her the greatest gift any human has ever gotten. And I walked out of that car in a daze. Like, what just happened? What did I do? And how can I always do that? It was the first time I ever really helped somebody or felt like I really helped someone. And a week later, I'm telling this story and they go, you could be a rabbi. I go, are you nuts? I can't be a rabbi. We're talking a year and a half, like I'm in recovery. And I'm like, I'm not really much of a Jew. And they're like, I don't know. You could be a rabbi. Why don't you go talk to somebody at the rabbinical college? I said, all right, go talk to somebody at the rabbinical college. They go, you could be a rabbi. You don't nearly know enough, but you could be a rabbi. Went to Israel for about a year, learned Hebrew, really immersed myself in the culture. And from there, got accepted to rabbinical school, and that was, 7-8 years
ago. So your defining moment was in the back of the car.
Yeah, it really was, helping this woman.
It's like you, Mark. Your defining moment was in the back of the car.
And you too, Gary.
That's right, Mark.
Both of us.
That's an incredible story. Yeah. You know that? It's
one I'll never forget.
We in recovery can do amazing things.
Yeah. You know, it's like funny. You think of like what is spiritual? We always say, what is spiritual? You know, people think like, do you have to see something, hear something? My spiritual moment was being in the backseat of a car with a person just who was grieving. That was one of the most spiritual moments of my life. And that, and you know, so it brought me great hope for my own future. I didn't know that this was what I would be doing then, but I'm so glad it happened.
Betsy Green says, I grew up in a religious Jewish family. When I admitted to my parents that I was an alcoholic, my mother said Jews don't become alcoholics.
Well, that's a horrible stigma that really exists.
It's true.
There's an old Yiddish phrase called a shikser is a goy, and an alcoholic is a non-Jew. And it's a harmful expression that is very widely believed in the Jewish community. And if people could take one away thing from my story, it's that this could happen to anybody, even your rabbi.
Well, Betsy has 33 years. Look, it was – prevalent in the Jewish community, I know it has changed. I started an AA meeting in a synagogue. Yeah. I go to churches, I don't care what it is. I could care less. And there was a little pushback, Jews don't drink.
Okay. We explore this question a lot. First off, the stigma is pervasive in our culture. It's all American, but it's even worse in the Jewish community. And that has to do with being a minority community in America and trying to show excellence and that we're rising above. But I also think in any religious community, there's a lot of shame and guilt. Did I do something to ruin my life? Did I do something morally wrong? And the answer is no. You've done nothing wrong.
Every community, you hit it on the – every community has shame with this disease.
Yeah.
And there is no other disease – that is accompanied with shame.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Diabetes, cancer.
Think about how many Americans are in treatment. I forget the number. It's like 6% or something like that.
Yeah.
Imagine if we were only given 6% of cancer patients treatment. I mean, it'd be horrifying.
Look, we talk about it. You knock on one of the hospital doors. You go in there and they say, oh, no. You have cancer. No, we can't take you now. We have to get in touch with your insurance company.
Well, that's why what we're doing here today, in my opinion, is holy work. We're changing the narrative. We're flipping the script. And more people who listen are gonna move from a position that's hardened to a softened position to want to help.
Listen, our viewers and listeners, if you need help, call the substance abuse hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-4357. And I can guarantee you whoever answers that phone, it will help you get into some kind of treatment situation.
Yeah, and get out of isolation. Reach out for help. Let somebody know what's going on. And we always say it too, call us.
Yeah, call us. What's the number, Mark?
888-329-3306. There we go, Gary.
My man. Hey, Stephen P. from Las Vegas, Nevada. My son says that if you take drugs like Oxycontin and they are prescribed by a doctor, there'll be no chance of addiction. Wrong.
Hopefully he's listening today, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was an avid Oxycontin user, taker, if you want to call it that, and that's not true.
It's absurd.
Yeah.
It's absurd. Right?
And, you know, Mike, you brought up a great point about how it's so easy to rationalize.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I'm getting this from the doctor. It's okay.
You know, I never got it from a drug dealer. And that was the thing, you know, it was always a friend or a friend of friend. And that was part of the issue. It was causing great stress every day coming up with the money and then the access to these medications because you run out of your prescriptions quicker and quicker. And this is also why, and this is important for everybody at home to listen, why many people end up going to heroin is because it's cheaper and it's more accessible. And many people, they can't afford the pills. They start there, but they go to heroin, which is obviously cut with a lot of fentanyl. And that's why you see these overdose deaths just skyrocketing. We got to get people into treatment.
That's exactly right. Treatment, 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 right?
Early.
Hey, Rachel L. from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Can you recommend a psychiatrist in the Harrisburg area that treats addiction? No. We could probably recommend a resource facility that could help you get a psychiatrist. But Mark and I, we don't do that. If you're looking for information about psychiatrists in Harrisburg, go to our website, cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com. Leave your name and number, and one of us will get back to you.
Yeah, we'll do a little research. And right now it's so hard because to get a psychiatrist, I'm running into it all the time.
I was going to ask you, are you feeling like you can't take new patients, right?
Well, in terms of with psychiatry, we do have availability, but the vast majority of places have huge waiting lists, and a lot of people are in crisis going through COVID. And
Mark,
everything.
I have found this over the years. A lot of the psychiatrists or general practitioners, they have no idea how to get you in treatment. None at all.
Yeah, we run into that a lot. We run into that a lot.
It's because state by state, everything's different. There's not a lot of good information out there. You know, this is where we need to do a lot of work and help people have the resources at their fingertips because right now people don't know. They just don't know.
This number that I read from the National Substance Abuse Hotline, it should be on your refrigerator, just like poison control, because once the person in your family or a friend decides they need treatment, you can't start looking. You need to have a number right then and there.
Yep.
And another thing is have some Narcan available, right? Have that available. Take the Narcan training.
Save a life.
And yes, have it available.
So, I mean, what the work you do, Rabbi, it must be so rewarding. First of all, you have the, as they call it, street credibility, okay?
Yeah.
It's what they call it, street cred. That when you're talking to your congregation about addiction, you've been there.
Yeah. Listen, I don't think that like only the people who've gone through it can talk about it, educate about it, because then I couldn't talk about half the things I help people with. But yes, it does provide a lot of credibility on this issue that, you know, that I'm somebody who's kind of trying to be a trailblazer here, trying to lead the way, push other rabbis. And believe me, clergy, I know a lot of clergy who are in recovery right now. This issue really does touch everybody, but everybody's got to educate themselves. Everybody's got to step up in their institution, in their business, and start these conversations because it's everywhere.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, right?
Did you go on and start like a recovery group at your—
So we're really excited about this, and we're going to talk about Freedom Songs
soon. We will
soon,
after the next
break. But the synagogue has just started an addiction task force where we're going to talk about all these issues. Support groups mainly for families, not even people in active recovery. Think about what addiction does to families. There's so much healing that has to go into it. And a part of what my calling is now is not only to bring awareness, but to help the families to heal a lot of those wounds.
It's so huge because it is such a family disease.
Yes.
And you have to have the family educate them.
Yep.
And it really helps somebody's prognosis of getting better.
Absolutely, with family support.
Yeah.
So have you considered having either Al-Anon meetings in your synagogue, AA meetings?
All that's on the table. All that's on the table. This is new for my congregation. It's new for a lot of congregations, but it's all on the table. You know, we're going to start with support groups, maybe peer-led, programming, obviously, and we're going to take it from there.
I'll tell you what we found out around this area. I started an AA meeting in a synagogue 38 years ago. And what we found was the people who had trouble in the synagogue didn't come to the meeting because they didn't want to be seen going downstairs into that meeting. So it's,
and I get it. I get it. The stigma of addiction probably then so much greater than it is now. And if people feel like this can hurt them, they're going to want – you know, that's why we're doing what we're doing. And listen, there is no good addiction. There is no bad addiction. Now, that's another conversation that people think when they hear my story. Oh, he had the good addiction. It was innocent. It was tragic. It's the – no, addiction's addiction. Don't judge anybody. I don't care if they were using these pills because they wanted to get high originally or because they were trying to treat an injury. The result is the same. And we just got to get everybody treatment.
Yeah, that's the key. Treatment, education, and money.
Yeah,
for
resources.
Treatment. Resources, you know.
I'm calling on all our publicly elected officials. You know, President Biden did talk about this in his State of the Union address. I'm really hoping they make this an important issue. We got to go further and further on this issue.
Well, we have some new news today.
Okay.
Federal government has – Brad, has it been passed yet? Through the House of Representatives, there is a bill now that they're going to – across the country, it's federal. They were – the penalties for low-level marijuana use, you will have your record expunged.
Good.
And the legalization of marijuana across the country. Now,
no one should suffer for what millions of Americans now do. You know,
I know. Look, there's abuse in anything we do. And if marijuana really does help you, because who are we to say you can't get out of pain?
Yeah.
There'll be abuse, but.
But as we talked about, marijuana use for young adults, that's the danger because developmentally young people, they don't realize the harm. It's, you know, so we don't want to, like I said, you know, we don't want to get into the discussion of like marijuana for some people. If it's medicinal, I do believe it is for some people. But for young adults, it's just a no-go. It's a no-go because they're not there developmentally. It's going to harm them.
Absolutely agree. Monica McNally Pokorny, who was our guest last week with Judge Eisenberg.
It was great meeting her in person, wasn't it?
Hi, guys. I wish I was with you again this week. I had to say, because we had to get her name right.
Yes.
Right? We had to get her name right. All right. So let's see. I have another – somebody just sent me an email. Can you guys do a show with active alcoholics or drug addicts? Well – we would love to do that, except it's a little risky. You know, I can say for myself, when I made a commitment to show up somewhere, I probably wouldn't show up.
Yeah, and we've had some times when we had guests not come.
Right.
You know, it's an open question in my mind of, like, what's the line between educating and glorifying? And I always lean to educating is always good, and I think there could be something good that comes out of that. Though, you know, it would take a really courageous person to openly come on and talk about being an open, you know, addiction.
Why do I have a feeling that would turn out probably badly just because of our luck, Gary?
That's what I envision, something insane happening.
Like
in
insane
here, right?
Happening, yes.
But that's the that's the disease of addiction.
It's the risk we take, right?
Yeah, but there are other issues because we're on the radio. I mean, cursing and
you know.
But a show like that with somebody who is pretty close to wanting to get treatment would be interesting.
Or it somebody who's relapsed. I mean, you know, we can't stigmatize people who've relapsed either.
Okay.
Everybody's got a story to tell.
Everybody's got a story to tell, as the rabbi said, right?
Yeah, and you know, relapse, we always talk about like just replugging in, you know. Sometimes it takes multiple treatment episodes till somebody gets clean.
If you're just joining us now, we're speaking with a rabbi in recovery, a Rabbi Michael Parise. Incredible story of having a lot of guts, let me tell you, and now helping everybody. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the Freedom Song Tour that's sweeping America right now. And it is a musical with people in recovery doing a show.
That's cool.
It's very cool. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF-NOW. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
All right. So as we said before the break, we're going to talk about the Freedom Song Tour. And this is a musical. It is based out of a rehabilitation facility in Los Angeles, California. It's called Beit Teshuva. And it is a rehab. It's, you know, you can tell by the name. You don't have to be Jewish to be in there. And you don't have to be Jewish to enjoy this show. I have seen it. These are people who are in recovery, who are putting on a show for everybody. And Rabbi, give us some background because you know more about this.
So Beit Teshuva, which translates to House of Repentance, is really one of the first of its kind. It's a synagogue meets treatment facility. And, you know, a few weeks after I had made my story public, Beit Teshuva reached out to me and they told me about Freedom Song, which is a nationally toured musical where they infuse the story of Passover. You know, the story of Passover is the exodus from Egypt, the exodus from slavery for the ancient Israelites. So much of that analogy, that metaphor works for addiction. And so they thought, what better way to tell the story of people's stories of addiction than to infuse it with another type of oppression and seeking liberation, the Passover story. So we're really excited at Temple Sinai of Cinnamons to host Freedom Song. It's this Sunday, 2:30. It is free. We are asking for advanced registration. You can find that at TempleSinai.com and TempleSinaiNJ.com. But we're really excited. You know, these are all people who are former addicts or in recovery. And they're going to be telling their story, and we're really excited.
And so this show has been going across the country. So look, go on their website. If you're not in this Philadelphia area, go on the website for Freedom Song Tour Spring 2022.
And it's for everybody, Gary. I mean, there's a bit of a Jewish theme to it, but it's really for everybody. You don't have to be Jewish to get something out of this experience.
Right, because we're all addicts. We're all in recovery, so we can relate to something like this.
I mean, more than most people know, look at this thing. Don't tell me millions of Americans aren't addicted to this thing, Gary. It's a phone. I'm holding it up.
I see what I saw. I recognize that.
You recognize – nobody – it's so true.
Is that an addiction? It is an addiction.
It is an addiction. And you know
Process.
What? It's a sad addiction because, you know, if you listen to some of these documentaries about the back, you know, story, they say – they purposely made it addicting. You know, you heard about the Gmail thing. You ever notice why you swipe like this for Gmail? Because they purposely wanted it to be like a slot machine. That every time.
No.
Yep,
well,
that's true.
That.
The programmers talked about it. They purposely made it a swipe in like a slot machine because they wanted that dopamine hit. Am I going to get that good email? Am I going to get that good email? Why do you think people sit there checking all day long?
I never knew that.
Yeah. I never knew
true
that
story.
Either.
True story. I think.
Yeah. What's your source, Rabbi?
My source is a documentary I saw on Netflix. So, you know, take it for what it's worth.
That's interesting. That could be.
Yeah. It's not the same source as our
your venomous
snails.
I was going to say, you know, I don't know if I want to be in the placebo test for that.
Let me just go a couple people here. Let's see. Mark, who do you have? Yeah.
I got my beautiful wife, Andrea Diaz.
Hi, Andrea.
Watching. And we got Mark Willig, our buddy who knows everybody.
Hey, Mark.
Yes, he does.
Do you know Mark?
I don't
Willig?
Know Mark, but you know, Mark, good, nice to meet you.
I'm surprised. He's like the first person that does not know Mark Willig.
We might be Facebook friends. I'm friends with a lot of people on Facebook.
Frank Griffin, Jeff Toosley. Let's see. Betsy Green.
He knows you.
He knows me?
Maybe so.
I do know Mark.
Well, you know what he says about you? What
did he say?
You're the man. Okay.
Thanks, Mark.
If you just joined us, we're talking with an incredible human being, Rabbi Michael Parise.
And
I say
is
incredible. I say incredible like the rest of us. We are incredible because we have overcome incredible adversity.
There are so many stories that are just like mine. And, you know, when you turn on the news at night, there's a real problem with the image of addiction in America. You only see the negative stories. Mm-hmm. You know, the news and the media, they don't like telling the positive recovery stories. They got to change that. And that's why, my friends, I'm so grateful for what you two do. You shine a light on the beauty of recovery, the beauty of the people who went through this process. And look at the guests you've had. Look at the guests. They span the spectrum. Athletes, musicians, rabbis. It's amazing.
Well, you know, just like us, Rabbi, I always say this. First thing is you're getting clean.
Yeah.
Then the next step is you're getting sober.
Yeah.
Okay? And then you give back.
Yeah.
And that's what you're doing.
You got to take a moment to focus on yourself, just like, you know, as they say, when you're in an airplane, you got to put the mask on for yourself before you can help anybody else. But once you do that, you know, the world is your oyster to really make a difference. And I find a lot of people want to make a difference.
Yeah. Again, if you need help, and this is why we are here, call 1-800-662-HELP. Listen, you don't need to suffer years and years like the three of us did. Get out of your misery. Yeah. You can get out.
And it's so important because what you'll find is you'll find acceptance. You know, you'll find other people that can completely relate with you.
Yeah.
You know,
community.
It's remember really feeling amazing. So alone.
Yeah, you know, it is a disease of isolation in many ways. I think they call COVID that too, but it is a disease of isolation, and you find such beautiful community and acceptance, and that, you know, that's what we're doing. You know, we're accepting and welcoming of people.
You know, I have a number here. If you're interested in the Freedom song tour, or you would like to bring that organization to your organization.
Yeah.
Call 310-204-5200. 310-204-5200. Listen, it's a bunch of old drunks and addicts who have overcome their adversities and they're giving back in a theater presentation.
Yeah, and I know they only tour about once a year. This is the tour right now. I think they have five stops on the Eastern Seaboard, but you know, if you want to do this for next year, if you're a house of worship, by all means, reach out to them. I think this could be something much bigger than it is even now.
Now, they will do this in a church. They'll do it anywhere, right?
I don't want to speak for the organization because I don't have those answers,
okay.
But I wouldn't imagine that it'd be an issue. But you know what? Reach out to them, Beit Teshuva. Yeah. They're going to have all the answers. Good people over there.
Yeah, it's giving back. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
So on a daily basis, how do you keep your recovery going? I know you're working with other people and everything like that.
There's a lot of burnout in the clergy field, just as a lot of burnout in the medical field.
Yeah.
And we got to be taking care of ourselves. Mm-hmm. I do that with clergy support groups. You know, there's always that weird thing when you're clergy. Can you go into a regular support group? And will people understand? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think self-care is really important. And I think we all have to find what works for us, you know, whether that's working out, going to the gym, listening to music, finding people who have also gone – you know, recovery can look like so many different things. And that's what I'm still interested in exploring. What can recovery look like every day in somebody's life?
Yeah, I mean, do you sometimes feel like your energy's been tapped? Like as I can imagine –
because of
like
what I do?
Yeah, sometimes we feel that as counselors where you just feel
– I mean – you know, I love what I do, and I always say it's not a burden to help people. It's to me, it's a great calling, but it does zap you of your energy. You know, there are days when I'm on the phone with doing a pastoral call where afterwards I say to my wife, I'm so tired, I'm so drained, and so you really got to take your time or you're going to burn out.
Well, in a way, you're a therapist like Mark.
Yeah, different. And I always tell people I'm not a therapist. I'm not a medical professional, but I am a pastoral presence. I am somebody who listens and helps guide. It's important. It's like different sides of the same coin.
And people put a lot of trust and faith into religious leaders, which is – I'm not saying it's an added burden, but it's an added responsibility.
It's why I did what I did. It's because I wanted to honor the trust and faith that you're talking about, that people put in me every day. I wanted to say to my congregants, I got that same faith and trust in you. I know you can handle this. And they could, you know.
Yeah.
And you know what? You know, weeks after, white-collar professionals, lawyers, doctors writing to me, I'm telling you, you know, this really touches everybody.
Look, the cool thing is, when people hear you're a rabbi or you're a priest or whatever, and you got into recovery, it's a big story, you know.
Yeah, and it's changed my life. And there are some days when I feel like, oh, should I have brought all this on to myself? But you know what? When I think about all the friends I've lost, when I think of the millions of Americans who have died, in my faith it says there's an expression, to save one life is like saving a universe. And if I could save just one life by telling this story, how could I not?
That's
how
right.
could I not do it?
Absolutely. That's how we feel with doing the yep. show. Michael, Rabbi Michael Parise, thank you so much
thank
again.
You.
You're our resident rabbi.
I got to be, and I love coming back.
You are?
Yeah.
And thanks for coming on the
thank
show.
You,
have a great weekend. And
Gary,
remember,
Mark, God bless you both.
Thank you.
Amazing.
Remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, help is available. Please call 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-4357. For Clean and Sober Radio, I'm Gary Hendler.
I'm Mark Sigmund.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about this broadcast, please join us on our mission at cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com. Have a fabulous, safe, and sober weekend.
To say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
Everybody is a star. Move the rain and shake the dust away.
System tries to bring you